Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to see you here. This is the first military history talk for this year. And I'm not going to say how many we've run over the number of years, but it's been going since about 2011 that we've been running these military history talks. It's really great to see the number that's here. It's always encouraging for our speakers to find that there's more than one person here. Now, it might sound silly, but we had a major general who came to give us a talk one time, and the only people were there was myself and Joe Hollander, who's the chair of the RNZ Charitable Trust. So it's great to have 60 ones here. So thank you for that. Today, we're being spoken to by Lieutenant Colonel Brian Webb. Now, Brian has done, about four other visits to us to talk, but this is the first time he's stepped outside the New Zealand wars for a talk here. So this is going to be quite interesting, views and the involvement of New Zealanders in the Boer War. And we've already found out there are some people here who are descendants of Boer War veterans. So thank you for coming along. And Brian, the floor is yours, sir.
Thanks, Howard. Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. So nice to see a large group of people interested in military history. And it's my pleasure today to talk to you about New Zealand's involvement in the Boer War. I've already met some of you who have relatives who have been in the Boer War, and I find that particularly interesting, as New Zealand at that time of our existence was under a million people, in fact just on 750,000, and New Zealand's contribution to the Boer War, to the empire part of the Boer War, was the most of any of the self-governing dominions at that time. So we have quite a history in this part of the world. But let's start with how did this war start, where did it start, and so on. And if I can get this crazy thing to start. Okay, so what I've titled this here is Boer Farmers Against the British Empire. This is an interesting part of history in that in the same sort of era, in the colonial era as we can call it, the empire was at its greatest ascendancy and Britain called upon its empire to go to various wars, including, as you know, World War I and so on. So let's have a look at why was it that Boer farmers, simple Boer farmers, no military at all, artillery units only, but no other military, could bring the empire into a war in South Africa, of all places. So Europeans fighting Europeans in the tip of Africa. How did this occur? Why is it important for us to learn? Okay, it's hard to understand this war without going back into history to find a context, because it seems very strange that this type of European conflict should occur at the tip of South Africa. Let's go back to the 15th century. I know that's a long way away from the Boer War, but we have to actually go back that far to find the context within which this war is fought. I want to go back 500 years, and you might think that's a long time, but let's see why it isn't. At that time, there was a papal bull, remembering that in Europe in particular, the only religion there at the time was Catholicism, and so a papal bull, in other words, a directive from the Pope, held great sway at that time. So this was Pope Alexander VI, and in 1493 he issued this papal bull. There are hundreds of papal bulls, of course. The last one that I can find was in April in 2015. So what this papal bull did was it established the so-called doctrine of discovery. And this established the spiritual and the political and the legal justification for colonization and the seizure of lands anywhere in the world that were not inhabited by Christians. So this provided the framework for the great start of the Christian exploration of the world out of Western Europe and Britain, and it established the framework for them, in the name of their sovereign, to claim territories uninhabited by Christians. If these lands were vacant of Christians, they could be defined as discovered and sovereignty seized. Does this sound familiar to you in terms of Captain Cook? This particular papal bull established a deep demarcation line 100 leagues or 550 kilometers west of the Azores in the Atlantic, and allowed Spanish explorers in particular to then go west into the areas discovered by Columbus and to establish the expansion of the Spanish Empire into the New World. You might think that I'm going back too far and that it doesn't apply, but strangely enough, even the US Supreme Court in 1823, in a case of Johnson versus McIntosh, upheld this doctrine of discovery. And it said that the principle of discovery gave European nations an absolute right to the New World. This meant, of course, that American Indians, who were non-Christians, had only the right of occupancy, which could be abolished at any time by discovery of Christian explorers. So this doctrine of discovery became the basis of claims of all European nations in the New World, and ultimately outside of the New World, in all other countries where Christians did not occupy land. So let's now come to our part of the world of interest now and have a look at Africa itself and how this doctrine affected Africa. This smorgasbord and kaleidoscope of colours shows you what happened in Africa between 1881 and 1914. You can see here the European nations that grabbed land in Africa and claimed it under this doctrine of discovery, and it became part of their empire. Remember, this was the great expansion of empires of the Western European countries into the world. This was what happened to Africa. You'll see that there are only small areas of Africa that are not claimed. And the reason why they were not claimed was that there was nothing there. This is a battle for resources. So let's now go into our part of the world that we're interested in, South Africa. So in the beginning in South Africa, let's go back to the first contact of Europeans into the African tip of Africa. So 1652, Dutch, German and French Huguenots, remember that Huguenots were in fact the followers of Calvin, they were Calvinists, and they were in a sea of Catholicism in Western Europe. There were refugees, therefore, from the religious persecutions that were occurring against them, particularly in France. So just 5 years later, The Dutch then started to take an interest in the tip of Africa, and they formed the Dutch East India Company. Remember, the Dutch already had as part of their empire what is now Indonesia, which was the Dutch East Indies at the time. So they established Cape Town as a victualling port and stopover port for their ships going between Holland and Indonesia. To do this, they formed two colonies, which were established in 1657, shortly after the Huguenots arrived to settle in the tip of Africa. They formed two colonies, Harmon's Colony and Stephen's Colony. Their principal reason was for cattle and fruit and vegetables for restocking ships on their way to or from the East Indies. There was almost an immediate conflict between the original Afrikaners, as they now called themselves, or Boers, as they called themselves, settlers, and the Dutch in the East India Company. So the Boers start to move inland, away from what they saw as an oppressive regime by the Dutch. And as we know, this is when the so-called Great Trek starts. They simply packed up their wagons, and in groups, or even just as single families, they moved into the hinterland, into the High Veld, over the Drakensberg Mountains, in order to get away from what they saw was an oppressive regime. The Dutch, meanwhile, established three districts in the area of the Cape. The first district was Stellenbosch, Graaf Reinet and Swellendam. They established themselves there and the Dutch government sent out a governor, and they were pretty well controlled by a small army. Of course, at this stage, the British had had no interest in the Cape. Now, at this stage of the Dutch settlement there, the British started to take an interest in the Cape for strategic reasons. Why? Because, of course, Napoleon, who had now held sway in France and Italy for some years, had ambitions to move into Egypt and finally into India, which was, of course, at that stage under British sway. Napoleon, unfortunately, did not have a navy that was able to face up to Nelson's British navy. The French navy was beaten at the Battle of the Nile. The French were then isolated, or Napoleon was then isolated in Egypt, and abandoning his army, not for the last time, as we know, abandoning his army, he moved then across land, surreptitiously back to France. At that stage, of course, in France, he carried out his coup d'etat and declared himself emperor. This was now a great threat to British strategic concerns east of the Middle East. Remember, this is pre-Suez times. So the Cape becomes a very important strategic position for the British, in order to prevent it from falling into the hands of the French and preventing them from moving to the Far East. So Britain can't afford for the Cape to fall into French hands. She has to do something about it, which in her imperial might she is able to do. And in 1886, Britain invades the Dutch colony in the south of Africa, defeats it easily, and takes over the Cape. The Dutch are in such a weak state at this stage of their existence that they have no option, but eventually, under pressure from England, they cede the Cape to the British. And the British establishes the Cape Colony. So let's have a look at how the Boer republics developed. Now, this is an interesting part of their history, because we see the Boer republics as being just the two that were engaged in the Boer War. This is not so. The Boers had a great propensity to establish republics. And here they are. First of all, the Republic of Swellendam in 1795, followed by the Republic of Graaf-Reinet, followed by Zuid-Pannonburg, the Natalia Republic, the Orange Free State, which is familiar to us, the New Republic, Goosen, and finally the Griqualand Republics. You have to say that none of these republics, with the exception of the Orange Free State, actually was a viable economic entity. And they started to fall apart. Arguments developed. Each Republican president wanted to establish himself. Most of these republics faded away or were absorbed, but some moved east and west in an attempt to get away from each other and establish their own political entity. None of them, unfortunately, with the exception of the Orange Free State and what then became the New Republic, which was the Republic of Transvaal, as we know it, had any chance of establishing themselves economically. So eventually they coalesced. And they coalesced, as we see here, into a number of other republics, each one of them with a president and so on. So we had Griqualand West, Griqualand East, Philippolis, Orange Free State, the South African Republic, small other republics, Natalia and so on, still looking for that independence of mind and religion that they wanted. So Griqualand was formed. Who was a Griqua? Griqua were mixed race groups developed in the intermarriage of Dutch men, Boer men, and native women. Still very strong in their culture in South Africa today. So Griquas formed a very major part of our story. Finally, let's have a look at what finally resulted around about 1885, just before the First Boer War. On the right-hand side, on the eastern coast, we had Mozambique and Portugal. It becomes important as we start to develop our story with regard to the war. The South African Republic, or the Transvaal, as it's now known, which was Boer occupied. The Orange Free State, which was also a Boer republic separate from the Transvaal. In the west, Namibia, or German West Africa, as it was called. Botswana, or Bechuanaland, which was a British protectorate, but with its own king. And the Cape Colony, which was British. Affecting most of it in a strategic way was also the Drakensberg Mountains, which stretch right across the southern part of Africa. I wanted to show you this particular map because it showed in 1890 the railway systems in the whole of South Africa. Rail was the principal method of opening up the country, not roading, rail. And so you see rail here, and some of them have strategic importance. The one rail link that I want to talk about is in Lourenco Marques, which is in Portuguese East Africa, and it comes from Pretoria in Transvaal. This was the only lifeblood of the Boers during that Boer, First and Second Boer War, because everything else passed through British hands to the coast. So they had no access to goods or services outside of their landlocked Boer republics. We'll see how this affects it shortly. And then covering it all is the Drakensberg Mountains. This is the Sani Pass, the main pass on the Drakensberg. You can see it up here. And this was the route of most of the wagons of the Great Trek. You have to have a great deal of respect for the Boers in that they actually crossed the Drakensberg Mountains with their cattle, their sheep, and their wagons. Their wagons could not make the trip, so every wagon was dismantled on this side of the Sani Pass, carried over piece by men, women, and children to the other side of the Sani Pass, and reassembled in order for them to then make the trip to the High Veld where they sought to settle. It was an astonishing achievement. This is a drawing of the Boer trekkers escaping the Dutch and then the English, and around about 1700 they start. It shows them climbing the Sani Pass. It is actually a little bit of poetic license, because there was no way in which a wagon could get over that Sani Pass except in a disassembled state and reassembled again. So let's come to reasons why the Boer War started. Okay, we know now that there was this big conflict between British interests and the Boers' desire for independence. Most Boers in around about the 1830s, 1840s did not want to stay under British rule. There was a major religious reason for this. This, of course, is the time where slavery was abolished by Britain worldwide in its empire. Unfortunately, it was not how the Boers regarded slaves. You see this quoted quite often in Boer writings. They quote St. Paul's admonition to the Ephesians and the Colossians, which says, "Slaves, obey your earthly masters." This is then used as a justification for slavery at that time. There were other reasons, of course, why they didn't want to stay under British rule. Britain, of course, at the same time as they abolished slavery, abolished the Dutch religion, the Dutch language, and made English the official language of the Cape Colony. This went directly once again against the religious precepts of the Boers, and they, seeing themselves as the children of God, decided that their language was the superior and should be used, hence the Great Trek. As we've seen, they established these many republics out of their sense of very strong independence, even independence from each other. So it was a family-orientated republic. They had their constitution, they had their generals, they had their presidents, and so on. Every one of them established themselves in full flight as a republic. In 1877, Britain had decided to annex the Transvaal on a unilateral basis. They simply decided that it was in economic decline, it was becoming a bit of a drain on South Africa, and it would be annexed. So they sent troops into the Transvaal via Natal and took it over. However, British rule was so unpopular in the Transvaal, with all of these restrictions on slavery and religion and so on, that the Boers of the Transvaal rebelled and they threw the weak British forces out of the Transvaal altogether and re-established their republic. In 1881, there was an armistice signed, and this was in fact the first time you start to find something with regard to New Zealand here. New Zealand had actually started to put together a contingent in 1881 in order to go and fight for the empire in the Transvaal. However, with the peace treaty, that first contingent was disbanded. Let's further go on and examine these reasons for a minute. Now we come to the nub of the war. Most wars are, as you know, for resources, and here was a resource that could not be ignored. When you read about the discovery of gold in the Transvaal, you start to really wonder. Two children playing outside of a farm, just outside of Pretoria, walked into a field, a dusty old field, and they walked on a silver piece of dirt, right on the surface. That piece of dirt went for 1 mile, and it was pure gold. So gold now became the thing in the Transvaal. Most of the prospectors were in fact what were known as Uitlanders. These are outsiders, if you like, and most of them were British. So there was this enormous gold rush by British settlers in the Cape Colony into the Transvaal. Transvaal had a president named Kruger at the time, and Kruger refused to allow these Uitlanders to be citizens. They could not apply for citizenship. They could not vote. This was a cause of increasing tensions between the Transvaal, the Orange Free State, which supported the Transvaal, and the British. The British, deciding that they had to do something about getting back into the Transvaal, tried to do it surreptitiously with this force called the Jameson Force. The Jameson Force was located in what is now Rhodesia, and Jameson was encouraged to raise a military force to go into the Transvaal. Of course, there's a common border between the two, in the process, encourage an uprising of what they thought in Cape Colony were disaffected Uitlanders. They went in the hope of causing an uprising and thereby taking over the Transvaal. Unfortunately, the Uitlanders were having a pretty good time of it at the time and said, "We don't want anything to do with this," and Jameson Force failed. Was defeated and sent back into Rhodesia, the remnants arriving in Rhodesia. Cecil Rhodes, who was in fact now the president of the Cape Colony, was implicated in Jameson Force and had to resign. However, Britain decided that it was going to end war independence in both the Boer Republics, spurred on, of course, by gold in the Transvaal and the recent discovery of diamonds in Kimberley. Do you remember that lovely story about the way the diamond mines were discovered just outside Kimberley? Two young boys kicking pebbles down the street outside Kimberley picked up a pebble, looked at it, and realized it wasn't actually a pebble. The pebble was taken by their father down to the Cape Colony to be assessed. It turned out to be, as you know, the Hope Diamond of international fame. The Hope Diamond was on the surface just outside Kimberley. So, once again, a big rush into looking for riches, and Britain decides that it has to do something about taking over both the Orange Free State and the Transvaal. So we get to September 1899, and it was obvious, particularly to Kruger in the Transvaal, that war was inevitable. They could see Britain reinforcing the Cape Colony with soldiers, principally from India, who were supposed to be on their way back to England for rest and recuperation, were diverted to South Africa, and the army was built up very rapidly. In September 1899, our Prime Minister, Seddon, offered a contingent of 20 mounted infantry to Britain. Britain accepts it on one condition, that there were no Maoris in that contingent. This was going to be a white man's war. The same applied to all the other colonies who offered troops. None of their so-called native troops were to be sent. So let's have a look now at the way in which the two armies were organized. The Boer commando system, to me, is very interesting. Firstly, it dates back to those early days of the Great Trek, where individual families or small collections of families went across the Drakensberg Mountains into the High Veld. High Veld, of course, was not uninhabited. It was inhabited by many Bantu races, including Zulu. So they were warlike races that they were going into the High Veld against. So when danger threatened, the rule that occurred in all of those little republics was that all Boers or burghers or citizens, as they might be called, between the age of 16 and 60 were required to join local commandos, as they were called. Each man who joined that commando supplied his own horse, he supplied his own rifle, ammunition, and 2 weeks of rations. After those 2 weeks, the central government of that republic took over the resupply. This is interesting from a perspective of later armies. The commando members elected their own officers. So they had a vote and elected a particular officer as their leader. But they could vote to disobey their officers if the majority of them didn't like it. This made for an interesting democratic process, which I am unfamiliar with. Commandos could coalesce into larger groups from time to time, they then came under the command of a general who was appointed by the president of that particular republic. Now, this system worked perfectly well for what the Boers needed at that time. The British officers, used to a much more formal organization, cast a lot of scorn on this system, but we have to remember that for 200 years, this system had worked perfectly well for the Boers. So both of those republics that finally coalesced into the Orange Free State and the Transvaal, the only established military units they had was the artillery. For obvious reasons, there was a lot more training required to put artillery shells on the ground in any sort of accurate manner. So they were the formed military, no other formation. The great statement that you hear in the Boers, and in fact in South Africa even today, is by God and the mortar. This is a typical commando. This is a family unit, three generations standing there, and you'll notice that they all are armed with the latest Mauser magazine-fed rifles. So, just to reiterate, about 100 to 200 men in a commando. Boer army was basically non-existent at the time of the opening of hostilities. The Boers were armed with the latest weapons, Mausers, machine guns, rifled artillery, and it was bought with gold and with diamonds in the two republics. And this is where the port of Lourenco Marx comes into being. There was no way in which they could import this from Europe. Most of this, as you can see, is German manufactured. Why? Because Germany was intent on making mischief for the British Empire in order to expand its own empire. So agents from both of these republics went to Europe and negotiated the purchase of all of this material, which came through Lourenco Marx. Unfortunately for the Boers, they never got round to the, if you like, the infrastructure of war. There was no supply chains. There was no ammunition resupply, and very little medical facilities. So the problem for the Boers was that if they stood and fought in one place, they were at a disadvantage. Their advantage over a military system like the British was to move and move and move again. If they stood still, they died. And they very quickly found this out in a couple of their early battles where they thought they would fight with fixed lines. They were roundly defeated, and then they turned to that form of asymmetric warfare or guerrilla warfare we've become very familiar with. This was the start of the asymmetric warfare we now know. They were bound together by religion and family ties, but almost no coordination of military strategy and tactics was able to be done. This is in the era, of course, before radio communications. Communications were slow and cumbersome, and therefore you needed a very strict organization like the British had in order to achieve that.